Welcome back. That was Blue Bossa by Dexter Gordon. The great Dexter Gordon died on this day in 1990. We're about to talk to Fleet Mowell, who served 14 and a half years in prison. And while in prison, he found a world that he touched on a little before he went to jail, but found another world. And out of that world came what he's doing now, which is the Prison Dharma Network, Peacemaker Institute, the National Prison Hospice Organization. He's the author of the book Dharma in Hell, Prison Writings of Fleet Mowell, and he'll be coming here to Morgan State University this weekend, where he'll be doing a workshop called Awakened Leadership, Community Engagement Practices and Creating Enlightened Society. You can go to baltimore.shambhala.org for more information. And Fleet Mowell, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us, man.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So I was very intrigued by what I've read that you've written and by the pieces I've seen and the videos I've watched. But I just wanted for our listeners kind of take a step backwards in time, I'm sure most people do when they talk to you at first, to talk about you. I mean, that's an interesting juxtaposition that you had gone to Naropa University that we can describe in a moment and then did 14 and a half years in prison for drug dealing.
Yeah, I'm one of those baby boomers that, you know, came of age in the early 1960s. And, you know, I fell headlong into the counterculture of that era. I was, for whatever reason, I'd become pretty, you know, socially, politically alienated and kind of given up on the culture. And so I just went headlong into the anti-war politics, the counterculture, the whole world of drug experimentation and so forth throughout the 1960s and early 70s and made a lot of bad choices led me to get involved in some really harmful activity. I ended up living outside the country as an expatriate. I justified that with my political views or apolitical views and it justified it so much with this kind of us versus them mentality and my own sense of righteousness about, you know, the society and the culture being completely hypocritical and the political system being hypocritical. And I justified that so much to actually fall into kind of an outlaw or a criminal lifestyle.
Which was easy to do then, too.
Yeah, it was probably easy to do then, but, you know, I still got very much my life today is about, you know, being responsible for my own choices. So I made a lot of choices back then that were misdirected. Even feeling the way I did about all that, there's more creative things I could have done, I think. But at any rate, that's where I went, and I got involved in, I was living in South America as an expatriate, got involved in small-time drug smuggling as a way to just live outside the country, live outside the system. But I was always a spiritual seeker, it had always been, and living high in the Andes Mountains, a very remote valley, when I first heard about the founding of Naropa, then Naropa Institute, now Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado, by the Tibetan meditation master Trungpa Rinpoche, and I knew I'd already been pretty much figured out in high school I was a Buddhist, and I kind of had narrowed my study in on Tibetan Buddhism, although there were very few books available back then, and then I read about this Tibetan master who started Naropa University, and I knew I had to go there, and so I went there, and I managed to get went back to school, got a master's degree in Buddhist and Western psychology, or what they now call contemplative psychotherapy. But I was still caught up in, you know, this lifestyle, and I kept this secret life of disappearing once or twice a year and doing a smuggling run, and was able to live outside the system that way. And my marriage was falling apart, I was able to kind of keep my problems at bay with the money. And I knew I had to get out of that world, but before I was able to, and I was dealing with a lot of internal dissonance, you know, I knew that the activities I was involved in were not good, and I was trying to lead this, you know, getting very involved in deep Buddhist training at the same time, and I had this kind of split life of spending about half the year doing really good things and half the year being involved in this crazy lifestyle of a smuggler and kind of cocaine cowboy character, and before I could extricate myself from that, it all caught up with me, and I was indicted, and I was considering whether to stay and face, I was being threatened with, you know, a long time in prison, and I was trying to decide whether to run or whether to stay and face it or what I should do, and on the advice of my spiritual teacher, I decided to stay and face it, and I turned myself in when I was indicted, and ended up serving 14 years in a federal prison.
And prisons are tough places.
They are tough places,
to say the least.
to say the least. I wasn't in the toughest of prisons. It was tough enough. Believe me, it was tough enough. It was a maximum security federal hospital. In the federal prison system, there's probably four or five hospitals, medical and psychiatric, around the country. And the one in Springfield, Missouri, where I did my time, is the highest security. So the patients there are patients that they bring from all the high-security penitentiaries around the country, the infamous penitentiaries like Atlanta and Lewisburg and Leavenworth and those. And so it was a very high-security place. I was in the general population of inmates who they call the work cadre. They had about 300 of us who were there just to help run the place, to work in housekeeping, food service, the hospital orderlies. I ended up getting, since I had a degree, I ended up getting a job teaching school. So I taught school for 14 years. With the prisoners, helping them get their GED or learn to read, or in some cases, helping them with college correspondence courses. But they had about 1,000 patients there, about 600 medical, about 400 psychiatric, and it was a place of just profound suffering, profound, profound suffering. And, you know, not as dangerous as being at one of the penitentiaries, but dangerous enough. There were certainly killings while I was there, there were fights and stabbings all the time. And it's just, you know, generally a very intense and hard atmosphere.
This explanation was in you, but the path you chose to take of creating your own small meditation center in prison and expanding that to other brothers who were in the jail with you, I mean, it obviously was a transformative for you, but began the transformation that you're still committed to.
Absolutely. You know, when I got locked up, or even before I actually got to the federal prison, I spent 7 months in county jail, and really, as soon as I got locked up, it was just like I completely hit the wall, and I was just devastated over what I'd done to myself, but more so what I'd done to my son, who was 9 years old at the time, and leave him and his mom just high and dry, and the shame and embarrassment I brought to my family and the community, my spiritual community. I really felt I'd let my teacher down. I was just devastated, and I just became radically dedicated eradicate any kind of negativity out of my life and to do something positive with all the gifts I'd received. Because I grew up in a basically good family. We had our issues, but I've been given a lot. And then I had so many gifts from my spiritual teacher and one of the great Tibetan meditation masters. And I just became radically dedicated to do something positive within my life. And also to leave I didn't know if I'd survive prison. I never had any illusion that I was certainly going to survive prison. And I wanted to leave a legacy for my son better than just my dad went to prison and died there. So I was extremely motivated. And also I pretty quickly realized that there was a fork in the road there. There were probably many forks in the road, but even amongst, you know, fairly positive ones, I could have led a very kind of hermit-like life there. At least in that prison, you kind of had to have a job, but you can get jobs that are like an hour a day, or you can have a full-time job, like I did. But you could get a job as an orderly up on your unit, probably have an hour, hour and a half of work, and spend the rest of the time reading, you know, writing, going to the rec center, doing whatever. And I chose rather to get engaged in that world. I knew it was going to be my world. When I first got locked up, I thought I was going to be there for 30 years. And, that's a big chunk of my life. I don't want to just flush it away, and I wanted to show up and do something. And really, the influence of my teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, who was a man who just, in my experience of him, just lived 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in service of humanity with no other agenda that I could ever see. And so, you know, he was just kind of, the spirit of him was just right there with me. And it would have been hard to choose a life of non-engagement or just kind of hiding out. So I chose to get engaged, and I worked full-time, and I started meditation groups, and I ended up with another inmate, able to start the first hospice program in a prison anywhere. And it became my community. And I was led a really engaged life for those 14 years, and also was really focused on training myself. I embraced the life of being a monk in prison, and just, you know, I led this very disciplined life in there of practice and service. But I don't want to paint it in heroic terms. It was out of a sense of desperation almost, because I realized what I'd done with my life, and I realized the jig was up. And it was time to really make a change.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about as I was looking at the work that you've done was and I was thinking on conversations I've had in the past with Claude Anshin Thomas on the show, who was a Vietnam veteran who became a monk of a different order, but became a monk following.
Yeah, I know Claude. I know Claude quite well.
Following Thich Nhat Hanh, and I was thinking about how the violence of war, or the violence of prison, And that inside of somebody, men and women, but I'm thinking this time of men for a moment, who have gone through that kind of trauma of violence or incarceration or facing an enemy and fighting and taking lives or being threatened by that or threatening back, that to find the power of beauty and peace inside those men is a very, for want of a better term, powerful moment, powerful thing to do. And I think that's what we miss so much about men who are doing time and what, because it is, you know, because I remember a friend of mine who spent a lot of time in prison said, you know, you can choose to lead the life of a monk when you're in prison if you want to and really change yourself because of this, because of the atmosphere you're in. You're almost like in this, you're imprisoned in a giant monastery. You're not getting out.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about kind of that, your history of that and kind of your approach to the men, you know, because people see, because these are hard men. They've been through a lot. So, you know, but about that transformative process and how that worked for you and for those men that you worked with then and work with now.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of parallels. And unfortunately, actually, there's an awful lot of veterans who end up in prison.
Absolutely, yes.
Even the prison I was in, we had a lot of Vietnam vets there. And so, there's a lot of similarities to the environments. And they're, you know, one is exposed to profound levels of trauma and people suffer from PTSD. And a lot of prisoners end up with mental health issues. I mean, huge numbers of prisoners end up with mental health issues, especially the ones that are in the higher security prisons. You know, there is something about the intensity of the environment, intensity of the situation, which can lend itself to transformation. It can also lend itself just to complete destruction. I don't want in any way romanticize the prison environment.
No, I wasn't trying to do that at all. No.
I didn't think you were at all, but I mean, I don't want to do that for your listeners because for the vast majority of prisoners, prison, they come out worse than when they went in.
Correct.
Prison's a debilitating, dehumanizing, destructive experience. But for some, for whatever reason, have the ability to embrace it as a path of transformation. It's a very deep journey, and there's a lot. I mean, we have over 2 million people locked up in prison, and you know, there's a big turnover. 700,000 of those get released every year. So there's a lot of people going through our prison system, and there's a lot of long time prisoners, and there are tens of thousands of those who are deep practitioners in one tradition or another. And often it's people who've worked with lifers lifers after they've been down for a while and they've kind of figured out the prison thing and they've gotten through all the craziness and they've gotten a little older, they develop a lot of wisdom and they have a certain kind of integrity and some of them may still be caught up in the gang life and those kind of things and there still could be some really untoward stuff going on, but some really is kind of step out of that altogether. But there's something about, there's just something about the challenge of that environment that if someone's able to not be crushed by it, it develops people who have a lot of depth. And one of my inspirations is really is we're trying to, you know, through the organization, which we now call Prison Mindfulness Institute, we also have Prison Dharma Network as well, but we're doing both the kind of faith-based work as well as the more secular approach to bringing secular mindfulness and meditation to the mainstream of prison programming. And, you know, we're trying to help everybody that's in prison. And I have a personal kind of inspiration to find those individuals who are in a process of transforming, and because I think they can come out and become real assets in the community. And most of them come from communities at risk that really need leaders and need strong people, and both men and women. And I think that's one of my real inspirations is to discover those people in prison and help them find their way through a path of transformation and back into their communities where they can really show up and provide the leadership that we all need.
Talk a bit about this idea you have. I know you're going to share at Morgan this weekend as part of your work, radical responsibility and what that means.
Yeah, I think this is an idea that you find within many of the world's philosophies and religious traditions, but I call it radical responsibility because it's kind of taking it a leap further than most of us normally embrace, and certainly that we culturally embrace. It's really the idea that of embracing 100% responsibility or ownership for any and all circumstances we face in every moment of our life. Now, when we get honest with ourselves, we can see that we have a hand in creating a lot of the circumstances we find ourselves in. And that was certainly my approach when I got to prison. I mean, I had all kinds of, you know, I could have blamed all kinds of injustices. And, you know, there were all kinds of injustices in the way I was prosecuted and tried. And I had people who stabbed me in the back, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I knew well and good that I got myself there and that my path of transformation was going to be about taking total responsibility for having got myself there and also for the harm I'd created in getting myself there, and not to waste any of my energy on blaming anyone or anything else. So it's this idea of embracing 100% responsibility for these circumstances. Even some circumstances, we may get as honest as we can. We may feel like, you know, I don't see I have any relationship to that, you know, unless you believe in past life karma or whatever, something like that. But really, mm-hmm. You look and say, I don't see that I have any relationship to this, and maybe it feels like a great injustice. And there are horrible things that happen to human beings, horrible things that should never happen to anyone. But at some point, you know, if it did happen to you, you have to look at it, okay, am I going to let this crush me? Or am I going to find some way to work with it, some way to move forward with my life, some way to not be victimized by it? And, you know, when people are victimized and people are in that kind of place of feeling victimized, I mean, that's completely normal. They may need to be in that place for a long time. It's not for me, or I don't think it's for anyone to tell them it's time for you to move on now or something. But I think we all know that if at some point in their life they don't find some way to step out of that victim mindset and move forward in their life, it's going to be very debilitating. So it's the idea of putting ourselves in a place where we have any real genuine power. You know, even if I'm in a conflict, let's say you, Mark, and you and I are getting some kind of conflict or something, and, you know, we're just loggerheads, and we go to a mediator, and the mediator listens to both of us, and we both have very compelling stories, and the mediator says, well, I don't know what it's like, he said, but we have the videotape, I'm going to take it out and show it to, you know, 10 really intelligent people who don't know either one of you, couldn't care less about either one of you. And so she comes back, and she says to me, Fleet, well, you know, they did agree with you that Mark's got to take more of the responsibility. In fact, they kind of felt, you know, he's got to bear at least 60% of the responsibility. And I said, well, wow, I'm glad you found such an intelligent group of people, and they realized it was all Mark's fault. And she said, no, you got to take your 40%. And I said, okay, I'll take my 40%. You know, but I feel vindicated in a sense, right? But why would I feel vindicated? I've just given away my power. Like, I can't control you. And if I think you're 60% responsible for how I feel, for my state of mind, for my happiness, for what's going on in my life, I'm giving you all my power, or giving you at least 60% in that circumstance. Because, you know, I can't control you. And we can't control anybody. You know, people do whatever the heck they want to do. We know that. How do we know that? Because that's what we do. I mean, you know, even, you know, well, somebody might be trying to influence us or manipulate us or control us in some way, but we're going to find our way. We're going to find our straightforward way, or we'll find our passive-aggressive, sneaky way, but somehow we're going to do whatever the heck we want to do. That's what human beings do. So, you know, one real simple thing, if we all want to be happier in life, give up the program of trying to control the people in our lives, you know, our spouses, our children, our
right.
Not to take care of children. But, I mean, just the way the energy we put into trying to control our lives and control the people in our lives, it's a complete losing game. So the idea is put my energy where I can have some creative force with it. In face of any challenge or any circumstance I face, what can I do to make a difference?
There's one piece you open. You said in your book, in the intro of your book, that I just actually started reading a little bit ago, so I haven't really finished it all, just looking at it. But you said, and I'm really fascinated by it, you said, here's the deal, life is very deep and you haven't been acting like it. Let's talk about that. You say that's how you open your workshop with the thousands of prisoners that you've talked to. Now, how you begin that way, and how does that relate to what you're going to do this weekend at Morgan?
Yeah, well, you know, I think a lot of us, as human beings, we share a legacy of really tremendous challenge and tremendous suffering. You know, and we could blame our parents, we'd have to blame our grandparents, we'd have to blame their, I mean, we'd have to go back and blame, you know, our early ancestors who were in the caves. I mean, it's just a human legacy of suffering and conditioning and programming that we all get, some of which is good, some of the program we get is good and helps us in life, and some of it's not so great, as we all know, and we struggle with it, and, you know, all kinds of addictive stuff and compulsive stuff and untoward behaviors of all kinds, and people grow up in alcoholic families or grow up under various kinds of neglect or abuse. And, you know, there's all the things that happen in this human realm, and there's tremendous suffering. And we haven't really been given the means, generally, culturally or educationally, to deal with that. So we mainly try to avoid it. And it tends to have us stay on the surface of things. And it tends to, you know, we want to try and find some way that we can create some sense that I'm okay and my life's okay and I'm going to go whistling in the dark down the street just hoping for the best, right? But we don't really deal. And for some of us, our conditioning has us in a lot of dysfunction in our lives. And some of our conditioning is pretty good and has us successful in our lives. But in many cases, even a very successful person, you know, they're kind of whistling in the dark and with a sense of, you know, anxiety and dread, waiting for that other shoe to drop, even though it may be subtle and they may ignore it most of the time or self-medicate around it. But it's, you know, what Thoreau called living lives of quiet desperation. They said the masses of men or human beings are living lives of quiet desperation. And it's because we don't get into the depth of things. And the depth feels unknown. It feels scary. It feels like there's suffering and hurt and pain there. But the path of transformation is actually about, you know, embracing our life and leaning into the challenge of life. And it's not that we have to, you know, do some kind of spelunking expedition down into the gnarly stuff of our conditioning, but it's like being willing to embrace the whole thing. And there's tremendous depth in life when we actually begin to relax out of compartmentalizing our life and trying to live in on the kind of, you know, it's like we want to live on the life of the topping, you know, like where you have a dessert and you have the topping, or you know, the Oreo cookie, you have the cream in the middle. We want to live our life on that level. We don't want to get in and embrace the whole thing. And life is going to include pain and pleasure. It's just inevitable on every level, physical level, emotional level, spiritual level. And the excitement of life and the profundity of life is when we can start moving into embracing the whole thing in some way.
So we've been talking with Fleet Maul, and this weekend he's coming to Morgan State University. He's going to be running a workshop called Awakened Leadership, Community Engagement Practices for Creating Enlightened Society. And you can get more information at baltimore.shambhala.org, and that's baltimore.shambhala.org. That'll also be on our website at steinershow.org to find out more. Fleet Maul has been doing a great deal of work through his Prison Dharma Network, Peacemaker Institute, a National Prison Hospice, Naropa Institute, Center for Contemplative End-of-Life Care, and more. And his book is Dharma in Hell, Prison Writings of Fleet Maul. And Fleet, thank you so much for this time.
Well, you're very welcome. Really enjoyed being on with you. And I'm looking forward to being in Baltimore and looking forward to a great weekend. It's a complete experiential weekend. It's not, I don't give lectures or anything. I give a bit of a talk on Friday night, but the rest of it is all complete experiential exercises that train us in the skills we need to manage our own brain, manage our own physiology, manage our own emotions in order to step more fearlessly into the challenge of life.
On our way to break, we're hearing who else but the just incredible Ella Fitzgerald. One Note Samba. On this day, Ella was born in 1917.